Welcome to Conversations with Big Rich. This is an interview-style podcast. These interviewed are all involved in the off-road industry. Being involved, like all of my guests are, is a lifestyle, not just a job. I talk to past, present, and future legends, as well as business owners, employees, media, and land use warriors, men and women who have found their way into this exciting and addictive lifestyle we call off-road. We discuss their personal history, struggles, successes, and reboots. We dive into what drives them to stay active and off-road. We all hope to shed some light on how to find a path into this world that we live and love and call off-road.
Whether you're crawling the Red Rocks of Moab or hauling your toys to the trail, Maxxis has the tires you can trust for performance and durability. Four wheels or two. Maxxis tires are the choice of champions because they know that whether for work or play, for fun or competition, Maxxis tires deliver. Choose Maxxis. Tread victoriously.
Have you seen 4LO magazine yet? 4LO magazine is a high-quality, well-written, four-wheel drive-focused magazine for the enthusiast market. If you still love the idea of a printed magazine, something to save and read at any time, 4LO is the magazine for you. 4LO cannot be found in stores, but you can have it delivered to your home or place of business. Visit 4LOmagazine.com to order your subscription today. On this episode of Conversations with Big Rich, I'll be talking with Joe Thompson. Joe is a fabrication business owner, successful KOH Ultra 4 race car designer, and an innovator in four-wheel drive race car design. Joe, it's great talking to you. I'm really looking forward to this interview and finding out more about you.
Well, it's good to be here. I kind of feel kind of honored, to be honest with you.
Well, so, it's just a regular guy interviewing a regular guy. How's that?
Yep, that's pretty much what it is.
So let's talk about the early days. We'll start off at the very beginning. Where were you born and raised?
So I was born in the Bay Area, raised in Mountain View, right on the peninsula there. Later on in life, moved to Grass Valley. And, you know, that was around my 20s. But for the most part, born and raised the Bay Area, spent a lot of time there. You know, obviously, I was a BMX mountain bike kid. And that was kind of, I was consumed by that in my early days. Well, for me with BMX, honestly, I think BMX is kind of what instilled, you know, kind of like the competitive side of me, like pretty hardcore, because kind of a cool story, but where I grew up in Mountain View, at the time I did, you know, basically I was in Mountain View as a teenager, you know, 85, 86, 87.
Okay.
And that was an absolute, that was the heyday of BMX, especially in the Bay Area. And, you know, we had, you know, three major tracks in our area, but we also had a ton of champions. Like, we're talking like the best of the best. You know, we had, I think there was like four or five Hall of Famers that came out of that area at that time. You know, we're talking like the best pros, whatnot. So like, right when I started racing, I was in bicycles anyway, I was surrounded by literally the who's who of BMX back in that time. And, you know, I'm on the gate with them, you know, and they're around me. And I had one guy in particular that would always, ride by my house. Like, he wasn't my friend. He was a top racer dude and, super well respected. And like, he was a factory rider. He was traveling the country and he would ride by my house every single day. And I remember when he would ride by, I would think to myself, yeah, there's a badass, you know, like I wanted to be like that, you know?
Right.
And, so I think at an early age, I had that kind of, I was competitive in school. Like I did Pop Warner and stuff like that. I've always been competitive, but it wasn't until bikes where I was able to see people around me achieving things. You know what I'm saying? Like they were right, pushing hard, training hard and actually achieving goals, championships and goals and number one plates and this, that, and the other. And, so that was kind of hammered in like early on, you know? And then I started riding with those guys and then you realize what it takes to actually win, you know, that the preparation and training and that kind of stuff, which applies directly to car racing. You know, there's no, there really is no difference. It's just a different venue, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, that was a, it was a major part of my life, you know, growing up there. It was pretty awesome. And I actually go there a lot to visit. Like even to this day, I regularly travel down to the Bay Area to go ride my mountain bike or whatever. It's kind of like, you know, a homecoming, you know, of sorts. So I go back there quite often to ride still.
I avoid San Bruno. I've shown Shelley, you know, where I grew up, and took one set of my grandkids by there, and that's about it. I go down. The only time I go to the Bay Area now is for 49er games.
It's funny. San Bruno was the town. I remember talking my mom into letting me do this, and she just fought me tooth and nail, but she drove me to San Bruno and I bought a go-kart off a guy. And I thought I just bought a trophy truck.
Right.
like at that age, I thought to myself, oh, wow, I've made it. I'm now Ivan Stewart, you know,
having something motorized.
Yep. Yep.
So what was school like back then for you? Were you a good student? Were you indifferent? What was it?
Nope. I was a terrible student. You know, it's funny because you hear all these jokes about, oh, I was just a bad tester. I was the opposite. I was a great tester, but, I'm pretty sure that, like, I don't really believe in all the label stuff, you know, but yeah, I'm sure that somebody nowadays would probably label me as, you know, ADD or something like that. But, did terrible in school, terrible with homework. People don't know this, but I actually dropped out of high school sophomore year. Yeah. So, high school dropout. And, you know, my school years were fun. I actually enjoyed school as far as like the social aspect of, but you know, again, all of my homies were BMX Groms. So we basically got to school and counted the minutes until we can go ride after school. You know, that's pretty much what school was for, was to waste time until we can go ride again.
Right. Kind of like the Southern California guys, you know, beach guys, you know, waiting to hit the waves.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. So wasn't a great student. I think I'm not saying that like it came easy for me. That's not the case. Cause I was definitely no savant, you know what I'm saying? Right. But things were like math and stuff was pretty easy for me. I had a natural, love of history and science, I guess you could say. And I already loved geometry. My grandfather was a pretty high up engineer with Lockheed. And, so I think a lot of that was kind of like in my DNA. So that kind of stuff kind of came easy to me. And it's not that I was, again, it's not that I was like above anybody else with school. It's just, I was a little bit bored with it, I guess you could say. And my mind was definitely elsewhere.
And do you mind me asking why you dropped out?
Honestly, I was, it was a couple things. I had at that time, I was racing BMX a lot. And I mean, I was going to nationals and, you know, whatnot. And I wasn't doing good in school. And, you know, I had a stepfather, and in hindsight, my stepfather and I have always, we rebonded later on in life, but you know, he was not from the same DNA as me. You know, like he was not a car guy. He was not a mechanic guy. He just didn't get me. You know what I'm saying? Like we didn't get each other. I got kicked out of the house. Okay. You know, but it wasn't because he was bad or I was just a total crappy kid. It's just that he just didn't understand me and I didn't understand him at all. Like we were just from different universes, you know, later on in life, when I became a parent, I learned that that's not that big of a deal, you know, like, people are just different and he did the best he could and, you know, and that's that. Right. And
right.
We came together later on in life when I was in my late 20s, and I realized when I was a parent also later on that there's no rule book. There's no guidebook. There's no template to follow, so to speak. So he knew as much as I did in that whole realm of things. But, you know, I ended up leaving basically because, you know, he and I didn't get along. And I only moved a couple blocks away to my best friend's house, right?
Right.
Who, by the way, is still one of my best friends. And he just bought a house here right near me in El Dorado Hills, which is super funny. But, you know, and then and that was that, you know. And I just went right to work and kept racing and you know.
What was the
kind
work?
Kind of follow my. So I worked at it was at the time it was the largest bike shop in California. I think it may have been the bike shop, largest bike shop in Northern California for sure. I think it was all of California as well. It was a huge shop. They had two locations, and they had, you know, they sold a lot. They sold over 9,000 bikes a year. And that's a huge bike shop. That's unheard of to these days. Like, that doesn't happen anymore. You know, but we were in the boom. We were in that, you know, that growth boom back then. And, you know, we had Stanford College right by us. So we had a huge clientele base. And so there's great locations, and we were right on the El Camino Real. So we had lots of traffic. And so I went to work there, and I moved up pretty much right away. I actually was running the whole bike shop within 2 years. I was a youngster, and you know, we had 15 guys there, you know, and it was pretty cool. I really enjoyed that time of my life, you know, doing that. I have always thought that when I am close to retirement again, or if I decide to get out of cars or whatever, I wouldn't be surprised if I opened a bike shop, to be honest with you. I really enjoyed that part of my life.
That makes sense. I mean, it's all about doing, I think life should be all about what you love doing.
Yeah. Except for doing what you love doing doesn't always make you the most money.
No. But you know, that's my grandfather told me, or asked me when I was 11 years old. He goes, "What is it you want to do with your life? What do you want to be?" And at that time I was really into scouting and backpacking and being outdoors and fishing and all that kind of stuff. And I said, you know, I want to be, you know, forest ranger or fish and game or something like that. And he goes, "Well, that's pretty noble, you know." He goes, "But, you know, as you gain knowledge and you get older, find out what it is that you really love doing in life and figure out a way to make a living doing it." And he goes, "And now when I say living, I don't mean, you know, how much money you make. You know, you have to make enough to survive. But how you get to live your life, you know, are you doing the things that you want to do?" And, you know, when I found off-road, that's what, you know, that's when I started to live.
Well, you know, when it comes to like the whole bike thing and off-road and how that all kind of came about, like for me, I feel like I kind of always knew what I wanted to do. Like, I didn't have a whole lot of, I wasn't that kid who was like, "I want to be a fireman," or "I want to do this." I always assumed that I would somehow be in some type of wheel sports. In my earliest days, I really thought I was going to be, build mountain bikes for the rest of my life. You know, like actually build frames. And I did build frames for a while. I built, you know, a few mountain bike frames and some dirt jumper frames and whatnot. But I always knew that I'd be in fabrication or kind of creation in some way. And I always thought it'd be some kind of motorsports. And even when I was a BMX Grom, like, I was glued to ESPN, you know, watching the Baja 1000, you know, watching Ivan Stewart. I remember watching that famous clip of Robbie passing Ivan. You know, when Robbie was young, you know, I mean, I remember being glued to the screen watching that and thinking that was just the best thing since sliced bread, you know? So I always knew that I'd be in it in some way, shape or form. Now, none of my family was in motorsports at all, not a single person. So I wasn't like around it or immersed in it, but I was very aware of it. And I was definitely a fanboy. You know what I'm saying? I loved off-road racing from the Mickey Thompson Stadium stuff to desert racing. I loved all of it, you know? Right. So yeah, I kind of knew that somehow in some way I would be fabricating, designing or building something, you know?
Right. So from the bike shop, what was the next step?
So I worked in the bike shop, obviously, for a long time up into my 20s.
Okay.
Early 20s. And then, I had worked on, it's kind of funny now because it's pretty commonplace, but back then I designed a gearbox for mountain bikes, and you know, so it got rid of the derailleur and whatnot, and it was a, you know, actually a, like a an actual geared gearbox that went, you know, at the bottom of by your crankset.
Interesting.
And I had worked on that, and I had hooked up with a guy back east, like a machinist guy. And I didn't know any better, man. Remember, I didn't go to college. I was terrible in school, you know, wasn't super structured in that way. And, but I actually was making good money at the bike shop, and I actually had quite a bit of money saved. It's kind of crazy to think that I, you know, the whole time I was in the bike shop, I actually was making a good wage and, had a bunch of money saved. And I just kind of jumped in with both feet and moved back to Pennsylvania for about 8 months, trying to see if I can't make my gearbox thing go. And it was a total flop, dude. I failed miserably. Like, I made some parts. I went to Interbike. I showed the gearbox to all the different vendors, and everyone told me I was nuttier than a fruitcake, and I had no idea what I was doing. And, you know, and that's literally what happened. I literally got shunned by everybody. And I was kind of, you know, and I had spent a lot of money. Like, for me back then, I think I was into that trip or that endeavor for about 30 grand. I remember spending like $20,000 of my own money. Like, we're talking like actual green money, you know, that I had in the bank.
Right.
And it was, you know, it was all gone, you know? But I did learn a lot though. Meaning I learned at that point in time in that whole process, that condensed time period, the amount I learned in engineering while doing that was crazy. The guy that I went back to Pennsylvania with, he was incredibly smart, almost too smart, like lack of common sense smart, right?
Right.
And that was also a learning process, because I saw it, you know, I saw him making decisions that were not based in like fact or based in like sound engineering, you know? And, so you kind of learn. It was kind of like my mom calls it my college time. That's what it was. That she's like, just consider that your college fund that you lost, you know?
Right.
That was the money you spent to go to college. And it really was, you know, like I did learn a lot in that time period. And I also, in that time, I had bought my first TIG welder, and I had, you know, was, you know, fabricating and, you know, building parts for my gearbox setup. And then once I came back, I was done, I lost all my money, and I moved right back to Grass Valley instead of going back to the Bay Area. Mainly because I had family there originally, and that's where we always vacationed. And I was always a mountain guy. I love the mountains. I love high mountain lakes. I love rivers. I love fishing, and I love obviously mountain biking. And so, I landed there and, planted roots there at that point in time.
Born a flatlander, but never felt like one.
Oh no. When I was in the Bay Area, I swear I was in those mountains, those Santa Cruz mountains, every day. I was never, my first car, by the way, my first car that I bought at the bike shop,
yeah.
I owned a Myers Manx. I owned two of them, actually.
Wow.
My very first car was a Myers Manx, and I was literally, and I fabricated my own bike racks for the thing on the roll cage. It had a roll cage on it when I bought it. And I fabbed up my own bike mounts, right? And, thought I was a, you know, professional fabricator at that moment. And then, and I was literally either at the track or the mountains every daylight hour, you know, and that translated over to when I moved back to Grass Valley. It was, you know, I felt like I was at home, you know. It was a great place to be.
Right.
And my brother is still there, by the way. My brother Brennan, he still lives there.
In Grass Valley?
In Grass Valley.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
So when you got to Grass Valley, and what was your focus then?
So I had, in that time period from the Bay Area to moving to Pennsylvania and whatnot, I had, by this time I had, quite a bit of welding experience. And I think that I was a fairly natural welder. Like, it just kind of came kind of easy for me, I guess you could say.
Yeah. You guys that can do that drive me nuts, but yes.
It's funny, because the welding thing is one of those things that, this is the best analogy I can give with welding and who's good and who's not. If you meet someone, right, that can dance really well, right?
Right.
They just naturally know. People who can dance really well could probably just naturally dance from the very beginning really well.
Right.
Like I can't dance. I'm horrible. Right. Now, if I went to dance school, I could get a lot better, but I would never be like Michael Jackson.
Right.
You know, cause Michael Jackson's just a natural dancer, right? Or was, or whoever, you know, you pick any guy, but it's the same thing with welding. Welding, some people just naturally know how to weld and some don't. Some can learn to be better, you know, but you know, I just feel I'm lucky that I was kind of blessed with being able to weld and understand the fundamentals like right away. Although now I'm suffering because my eyesight's going away a little bit, but you know, it was still a fun thing for me to do was weld and learn. So anyway, so back to the Bay Area. So I, or Grass Valley, I mean. So when I first moved to Grass Valley, I answered an ad when they actually had ads in the newspaper, you know?
When they actually had newspapers?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was so funny because the ad said, TIG welder must be good. It's exactly what it said. And it had a phone number. And I'm like, you know, well, I'll give it a shot, you know? So I called the guy up and to this day, he and I are still friends, and he and Brendan, my brother, are super tight as well. I call him up. He answered the phone. I said, yeah, I'm calling about your TIG welding position. And he goes, are you any good? And he said it with a tone of like, don't waste my time. And I was like, well, I've been told I have a good hand. You know, I mean, I think I'm pretty good. I'd like to at least try. He goes, okay, come on down. That's exactly how he said it too. With a hesitancy of like, I really don't want to have my time wasted, you know? So I got there and the luck of the, you know, the welding gods, you know, were shining down on me that day. Cause I laid down some good heaters and he hired me on the spot and I worked for him for about 8 years. He was building custom shaped, custom formed, custom sized, Harley, gas tanks. So the whole chopper craze that was happening back then,
right?
He was on the leading edge. He built tanks for everybody. We built all of Jesse James' original tanks. We built all the tanks for all the guys from American Choppers and you, the who's who of chopper builders. We built their tanks.
Nice.
So, you know, and I was the lead welder, and ended up like kind of becoming the production manager kind of thing of that place or whatever, you know. It was kind of a small shop. We only had like 8 guys at our max. But we were pumping out like 40 tanks a week.
Wow.
You know, and they were, you know, the tanks were expensive. They were, you know, $1,000 to $2,000, you know, give you an idea of what we were doing. And so, yeah, so I worked there and, you know, and that was my long time deal. And then in between all that, you know, my brother and I, accumulate a lot of tools, you know, and we were buying more tools. I had a tough shed that I was renting from a guy that we would do a lot of side projects out of. We were building roll cages and you name it. I was building bike frames and a whole bunch of random stuff out of this little tough shed. And, yeah, that's kind of where that went.
Let's talk about vehicles at this point. What, yep. You said you had the Myers Manx. That was, you know, your first car.
Yep.
What else have you owned and that maybe led you into the off-road world?
So I had a Myers Manx that I then bought a Nissan truck, you know, like the old hard body truck. And then I bought a Chenoweth off of, I don't know, Craigslist. I'm not even sure where I found it. Honestly, I can't remember where I bought stuff back then. I bought a Chenoweth. That I was hacking together to build a full tube Manx out of. And then what did I do from there? From there, I had a couple Z cars, you know, I had a 280Z and, but all of my cars, to be honest with you, all of my actual drivers have all been pretty boring. Like I've never been like a big hot rod or like, I don't have a lifted truck, you know, I'm not, you know, driving around a truck on Swampers or any kind of stuff. I've always considered my daily drivers as utility. You know what I'm saying?
They're just a tool.
That's just how I've always been that way, except for the buggies, you know?
Right.
Which to this day I still love.
So did you, I guess the trying to lead to is what led you into the off-road side of fabrication in the world?
Okay. So let me just back up with the whole, sure. With the whole bike thing and suspension. So I've been maybe a little bit bland here with this, but like I mentioned I wasn't very good in school, but I definitely was a reader. Okay. So okay. I did love to read and I read a lot. I read dumb, like boring stuff, tech articles, you name it. I was consumed by cycle news, mountain bike magazines, off-road magazines. It didn't matter what it was. It had to do with motors or engines or chassis or suspension or welding or whatever kind of stuff. I was reading it. Right. And I also had kind of a boring mind as far as like, I liked engineering stuff. Like I liked kind of dry reading. Right. And so when mountain bikes were big and you know, that was like the whole full suspension mountain bike thing was booming in popularity. I was fully immersed in that, which is why I designed the gearbox back in the day. I was fully immersed in suspension design. I took a lot of time to understand leverage curves and how that works and different aspects of suspension, what they do geometrically, you know, the kinematics of the suspension, what it's doing to the vehicle. And so I think I kind of had a good mental head start for off-road cars with that, because to be honest with you, bikes are the worst case scenario. Bicycles, I mean, are the worst case scenario for suspension design. Because they have the worst unsprung sprung weight ratios of any kind of like off-road vehicle. So they're the hardest to actually develop. And so I kind of already had that like burned into my brain. Like I was already a big student of suspension design. Okay. That was already like part of my everyday thought process was suspension this, suspension that, whatever. Right.
Right.
And so in that time period of going back east and then coming back, I always had my mind on off-road as far as like, I was, like I said, I was always a fan. I was always a fan of racing, always watched every race, watched every supercross, watched every off-road race, you know, that I could get my hands on. And so when we got our little tough shed in Grass Valley and we were starting to build stuff, we started really branching out. We did lots of wakeboard cages, lots of, off-road cages. I think the very first cage I ever built was for a Samurai. And, you know, we were kind of doing a bunch of that stuff. And then the guy that I told you that I well tested for, I went to work for 8 years, he actually lived on the same road as Kevin Yoder.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So my brother and I were going to work one day and we kept seeing this chassis in Kevin's yard. It was in the weeds, right? So finally one day I just went over there. I'm like, hey, Kevin, you know, I didn't know his name. I said, hey, you know, any interest in selling this thing? He goes, sure, I'll sell it to you. And he sold us that chassis for $300. It came with a green sticker. Right. And we thought that we had just struck gold, you know, and, we went back there and to give my brother credit, my brother did most of the grunt work. My brother's a beast when it comes to like working on stuff. And, we took that chassis. I basically designed the front suspension and designed some, the front suspension was kind of unique. It's too hard to explain over the phone, but had a kind of a unique front suspension. It had 39 inch Swamper or 39 inch IROX or no, excuse me, 49 IROX, 22R dual cases, all kind of stuff. Right. Dana 70 Snowfighter in the back, you know, we thought was the best axle ever created. And, we wheeled the heck out of that thing. And, my brother still has it to this day and it still runs.
Wow.
So, you know, there was that we dabbled in that. And then I opened a full fledged fab shop, an actual fab shop. And, I would always park that buggy on the street with a giant welding sign with an arrow pointing to my shop, you know? And so I got lots of work from that. And one day this guy comes in and he's kind of like, he has now become literally my father, right? He's not my dad, but he's my dad.
Right.
And that guy comes in the shop and he walks. I remember him walking through the door. Just cocky as shit. And he goes, hey, can you weld aluminum? I said, yeah. And just like, this is like my old boss. He goes, are you any good at it? I'm like, yeah. He's like, okay, I want you to build me a gas tank. I said, okay. He said, I'll be back tomorrow. That's exactly how he talked to me. You know, he still does to this day talk to me that way. And so he shows the next day with his rock crawler. And it turns out that he was part of that whole Rat Pack crawling crew, you know, Walker Evans and him and the Currys and all those guys, they all wheeled together. And I built him a fuel tank, and it turned out really nice. He was super happy with it, and kind of snowballed from there. He took me to my first trip ever going to Hammers. So I went with him. We went wheeling Hammers, and Highway 20, by the way, I think he named it. Okay. For breaking that trail at Hammers. I'm pretty sure it was him who named it, because Highway 20 is the highway in Grass Valley.
Right.
And took me my first trip wheeling to Hammers. I had a great time. I loved driving. You know, I had a really good time driving there, and I felt like I was kind of like a not a natural, but I'm saying like I enjoyed driving. It was fun to do, and I was competent. You know what I'm saying? I wasn't like a rock star, but I was competent. So then some time went by, and I was very active on Pirate, and I was working on some suspension stuff. I was working on some IFS stuff. This is when Shannon built his first IFS car, and I was, you know, kind of like really diving into that whole thing, right? But I didn't have a rig, and I didn't have anyone that had ever built a car for or anything, right? I ended up – he knew Rick Mooneyham. Okay.
Okay.
This guy, Doug, that had me build in the gas tank.
And it's he Doug knew, who?
Doug McBurney.
Okay.
And so Doug knew Rick, and Rick was looking for someone to buy a seat in his TTF car for Vegas to Reno the long way. All right. Back in, I don't know what year that was, 2000? Was it 2000? I can't remember what year that was. But anyway, Vegas Dream the long way. That's when Dave Cole did it in his IFS car that what's-his-name built for him.
So like, more like 2010.
Yeah, you're right. 2010, sorry. 2010. And I paid for the seat. I talked to Rick. Rick lets me, you know, I drive. And I actually did pretty good driving. We were holding our own. I think I did pretty good. They said I did good. We did break a knuckle on the car. Had nothing to do with any of us. Just was a normal racing break, right?
Right.
And from there, I get a phone call from Rick like a month later. And he's like, hey, I just finished a car for somebody, and he wants to race Hammers. He wants a co-driver. And I told him about you. Do you want to co-drive for this guy? And I said, hell yeah, right? And that was Les Figueroa.
Oh, okay.
Yep. So he puts me in contact with Les. We're talking on the phone. I've never met Les my entire life. And Les is like, hey, we're going down here on this weekend, you know, and just come on down. So my first time showing up to Hammers ever, I cold called, just showed up in the lake bed, or second time to Hammers, you know, first time being there, you know, with somebody else, I guess you could say. Show up there and meet Les the very first time. And I remember looking over to the camp next to us, and there was John Reynolds with a giant sledgehammer straight in the wheel on his Unimog axle Bronco, which I thought was pretty cool. You know, like that was my first time seeing John Reynolds, who was a king, you know, is a legend on Pirate 4x4, right? I'm like, right. Oh, that's John Reynolds, you know? And so, Les and I formed a pretty good relationship, and I co-drive with him for a few years. And we actually finished, we finished ninth one year. That was our best finish. But we did good in the car together, you know, and then he sold that car to the brothers, actually, he sold that car that we had to JP Gomez, and he didn't even know who it was. Meaning they showed up with Bob Roggie, right?
Yeah. Right.
They showed up with a bunch of money. They test drove it, paid for it, and took off. They didn't really even know the names. You know what I'm saying? Like Les called me and said, hey, I sold the car. I'm not sure who I sold it to. So, and then from there, you know, I just kind of kept pushing on the building side of things. And I, ended up building a car for less, which he sold, and he actually never raced it. A few other guys have raced it, still competing to this day. And then I then went ahead and built that. Did you ever see that 1964 Baja Galaxy 500?
Right. Yes.
That's driven around hammers a couple times and stuff.
Yes.
We race it at the Benora Mexican 1000.
Oh, okay.
And so built that, and when I was done with that is when I weaseled my way into finally meeting the brothers and basically forcing an opportunity to build them a car.
How did that come about? How did it work out? I mean, not how did it work out, but how did you force that?
So again, we actually didn't know who bought the car, right? Like Les couldn't tell me who it was, but Les could tell me that it was in Northern California, and he could tell me it was near me, right? But he wasn't sure where. And Lotus, which is where where the Gomez brothers have their main facility, it's kind of like one of those places in the earth that it has a town name, but it's not like totally official.
Right. You know? I wouldn't call it a town.
Yeah. So if you were to look up Lotus, California and try and Google search Gomez, right? Nothing's coming up, you know?
Right.
And so we didn't know who it was, but I went to a NorCal rock race, and I'm walking through the pits, and I see the car in the far corner of the pits. And you have to understand that I meticulously maintained that car for 4 years, right? And at least on the fabrication side of things, Les did all the mechanical maintenance, but I did all the actual fabrication stuff, and it was in great shape when we sold it to him. Well, now the motor, the axle was broken in half. The front axle, it was in the pits. There's like four motorhomes around. The doors are open. There's like a smoldering fire. Parts are everywhere. There's an engine on the off to about 10 feet away from the car on its side. Front axle was broken in half. And I was like, literally, I walked. I'm like, what in the hell happened to this car?
Right? It got Gomez'd.
I literally called Les right at that moment. I'm like, Les, I found your car. It's destroyed, you know? And so never saw those guys. I never saw them at the race ever. Like, I never saw them come back. No one ever showed up at the pits. It turns out that Jim Kearns was down at Pick and Pull grabbing a motor for it, right? and the brothers were all, I don't know where they were. They were all gone. So that was my first introduction to the brothers, right?
Right.
Even though I never met anybody. So then the next race, I'm there, and Marcos was racing his IFS car that was built by Dan Trout and Bob.
Right.
And I don't know if you remember that whole thing, but I actually don't know the whole story myself, but like they started building it. Then Dan went on vacation, you know, came back, and there was some discrepancies, and I don't know, the thing wasn't fully finished out. Something happened to it. You know, it was just one of those builds that was, it was just a difficult build for everyone.
Right.
And anyway, that car was, it was breaking CV joints. So I walk up to the pits. The first time I actually see the brothers, and Jim Kearns is like up to his elbows in CV grease, and he's repairing the CVs in his car. And I just walk up they don't even know who I am. They don't know that I raced their old car. They don't know anything. And I'm looking at the car, and I'm looking at the front end, and I asked Jim, who I didn't know at that time. I'm like, so what happened to him? He's like, oh, we popped the inner CV, blah, 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 blah. And we're talking for a second, and he's kind of ignoring me because he's working. You know, he's working. And I'm kind of bugging him, honestly. And so I'm looking at it. I'm like, I kind of knew what was wrong with it, you know, just from glancing at it, I kind of knew what was wrong. And so I kind of weasel my way over to Marcos. And I'm like, so what's going on? He's like, oh, we broke a CV. And I said, I know what's wrong with it. And he totally blew me off. Like, yeah, okay, yeah, you know what's wrong with it? Sure, buddy. All right, get out of here. And, you know, whatever. Like some guy showing up at the track, right?
Right.
And I said, well, I'm Joe. I used to race your old lady car with Les. He goes, oh, okay. Then he kind of had, now there's kind of like a little bit of a connection there, right?
Right.
So we leave, come back for the next race. Same thing. Jim's elbows deep in CV grease. And I pulled Marcos aside and say, hey, I can fix that. I know what's wrong with it. And then this time he was like, really? You think you can fix it? I'm like, I can definitely fix it. Still kind of blew me off, whatever. The third time around, I got there again, same thing. And this time I pulled him aside. I said, listen, dude, I know what's wrong with the car. I can fix that for you. And he goes, you really can fix that? I said, I can 100% fix it. Get it to my shop and I'll get it fixed. He's all, why won't you do it at our shop? And I said, okay, you know. So I basically just reworked the front end. I reworked the, it had too much droop. You know, they were relying on the limit straps to limit the droop. And right. So mechanically it was over drooping and, you know, popping the CVs. And so I reworked that, you know, built some new arms and whatnot. And they never broke a CV again. And then I had a little bit of trust from, you know, the brothers. And I started doing a little more work for them. You know, they had a car that was started by John Hall.
Right.
John Hall started a car for Raul Gomez, but wasn't able to finish it. So after fixing Marcos's car, I went in and I finished that car for Raul. Again, not a job I really wanted to be doing because it wasn't my car, but I still finished it off for him. And then, and that's when we talked about building the twins, the new IFS cars for him.
And then the rest is history?
Kind of. One funny part about that negotiation, though, is when I went to their office, JP said, and I, not even joking, he said, I just want you to copy Shannon's car. and he was serious. And I said, no, I'm not going to build Shannon's car. I already have a car designed, which I did. I had a car that had, when I was racing with Les, I literally, in the first 20 miles of racing with Les for the very first time, I told him, I said, I have a car design. I'm ready to build this thing, you know? And, like I kind of already kind of formulated in my mind what I felt would be the best car, you know? And so I refined that design. I kept drawing on it over the years. And then when this time came around, when he told me to build a copy of Shannon's car, I refused. And I said, I've got something better. And I said, you guys need to trust me. You're not going to get bamboozled. You will have a winning car. And, so it took a little while. And finally I said, I think JP, you know, I don't know if you've talked to him a whole lot, but he's kind of a jovial guy. He's like, all right, fuck it. Let's do it.
Right.
That's exactly how he was. And so that's what we did. I built him. I made no money on the cars, built him in my garage. And, you know, that was that.
And that's that was how with, we, that was with your business was UFO.
So I didn't have any business name at that point in time. Okay. I was just me. Yeah. I had no business name. I had sold the other fab business. I had moved on from that. And so it was just, me working on my garage, my home shop. And yeah, no business name at that point in time. I didn't name it UFO until, you know, I mean, halfway into JP's car.
Okay. And how did the name come about?
So I had already owned the name. Okay. So I wasn't sold on that name originally. Okay. But I had already owned the .com name. I actually was kind of like a incessant .com buying kind of guy. Like I actually owned quite a few names of things that I wanted to build or things I liked. So I would like buy the domain and kind of set it aside, right? In case I could make something happen. And so I always liked the name UFO mainly because, you know, it's not a Jeep, you know, it's nothing against Jeeps. It's just that I'm not really it's not that I'm against Jeeps or Broncos for that matter, any kind of stuff, but I'm just, I'm more of a purpose-built guy. So like when you design a car, it's all about the bones and the performance first. And then the aesthetics are last, right?
Right.
So when you build in that manner, things tend to look a little different than what maybe the standard norms are, right? And so because I wasn't building a Jeep, you know, and I wasn't building something that was dressed up to look pretty, I thought, you know, UFO is a perfect name because it's a It's a fast car. Doesn't look like anything else. It's kind of an alien, right? It's not of the normal cut and cloth, and so that's where it came from.
Okay.
And then also, kind of funny story, because I get asked this all the time, so I figured it'd be good to clear it up with you anyway, is John Reynolds had built that car on Pirate, and he had called that one he built for who did he build that car for, that original IFS car? Do you know? I forgot the guy's name.
Was it? It's not the four. It's not the IFS R. No.
No. So John Reynolds built that. Built the IFS car for that racer who raced it a couple of times. Anyway, the company, his racing team was called UFO Racing, and John Reynolds titled the Pirate 4x4 thread as the UFO build.
Oh,
right. Yeah. And so, but I had already owned the domain name at that point in time. So it was just one of those things. So when that all kind of, and I kind of kept it quiet, like I owned the domain. I didn't really care. It wasn't like I was trying to like title the, you know, do anything with it at that point in time. And so, when I actually ended up building the car for JP and I decided that I was going to name it that, I actually messaged John Reynolds first. I said, "Hey, listen, I know you guys aren't racing anymore. I know you're not pursuing it. I know it's not like your company name. Are you guys going to have any issue with me taking this name and running with it? Because I already own the domain name. I already own the .com name before they even started their build thread." And he's like, "Dude, he's not racing anymore. I don't have any rights to it. You know, go for it." Right. And so I got Reynolds' blessing I didn't want to create any waves because he was, kind of, you know, he's a badass. He's a legend. You know what I'm saying? Right.
Absolutely.
And so I didn't want to start off pissing people off. Right. And things were small enough back then that people didn't really know, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of outwardly exposure for all the car names and whatnot, except for like Jimmy's obviously had a big, you know, a big name back then.
Right.
So anyway, that's how the name came about. And that's the confusion clear up. Cause sometimes I get asked that, you know, by guys that, you know, "Hey, did you build this car or whatever?" I'm like, "No, that actually was a John Reynolds built car. It was called the UFO build." And I'm always explaining myself, you know, that whole situation. But, and that car, by the way, was super awesome. That was a groundbreaking car in itself.
Yeah. I don't remember specifically that car. The one that I remember early was the one that, Rick Dermo's car that was full four-wheel drive independent that he and Randy had built.
And honestly, credit to Jimmy's 4x4 on that one. Because that car, when you look at it, if you were to go back in time and look at that car right now, how tightly they packaged that car and how well they packaged it is really impressive, even by today's standards. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
They did their own stuff. They figured it out. That was a really cool car. That was a neat car. You know, I don't think it really got the credit it deserved as far as breaking ground in the XRRA world or whatever, you know, and right. just being a really neat, well thought out car. It was pretty cool.
There's been a few that I thought were, you know, Randy Ellis had the Red Racer or whatever he called it with the four wheel independent. That was a racer, but it was more, you know, rock, you know, he brought it out to the rock crawls early. And then Walker and yep, Anderson.
Walker had that one.
Yep.
And so did Shannon.
Yeah. But they all bailed on it because, and it's typical like what happened with the desert racing and the four wheel drive, is that they couldn't get things, you know, they couldn't get it dialed in and they were trying to do it during the season. And,
yeah,
you know, they were interested in wins. So if it didn't work the first time, it was like, okay, scrap this. Let's go back to, you know, let's put let's go back to a drag axle in the rear and then see what we can do. And, you know, that.
Yeah, they didn't give themselves the time to see it through.
Correct. Right.
Yep, I agree.
So with now that you're UFO, you're building cars out of your garage in Grass Valley area, which I came up to because you were working on Jaron's car when I when I met you the first time. And did that for the magazine, the thing. And then you end up teaming up with the Gomez's even farther, a bigger relationship, and you move out of Grass Valley and you come into El Dorado County and you're working at the in Lotus there, or I guess that's a Lotus address. Where Mountain Enterprises is at, and that's where the shop's at now, correct?
Yeah. So basically what I did was I worked because I built a lot of their cars, right? They were ferrying cars to my shop all the time. And it was kind of a pain in the ass, you know, and they're kind of tough on cars. So, you know, there was always
that's an understatement. Well, you know,
I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of reworks. Like there wasn't a lot of chassis problems, but there's a lot of bumpers, a lot of, you know, redo this. Like when Marcos crashed his car end over end, you know, there's a lot of big reworks like that, you know, had to be repaired. So a couple things were going on. Doug, the guy I mentioned earlier that kind of got me into the whole thing.
Right.
He owned the property that you came to. So that was a 10-acre parcel that I rented for a long time from Doug that had the four-car garage on it.
Right.
And then Doug was in the house that was adjacent to that.
Okay.
You know, big house. He was on 100-and-something acres. And so Doug actually, he's now in Payson. He's in Arizona now, right? And so I knew he was going to be leaving, and I knew I wasn't trying to find a new place. So I thought about I actually had a deal on the table to buy that place. But you know, my wife that I married, Angela, that I married, she's from here. She's local to, you know, Coloma, Lotus area. And so she already had family here. And I honestly was ready for a change because I'd been in Grass Valley for a long time. And I kind of thought, you know what, now is a good time for me to make a move. And to be honest with you, Grass Valley was getting a little bit bigger than I liked. Like just a little too much, I don't want to say city folk influence, but just wasn't the small town it was when I moved there.
Right.
That's all. And so in Georgetown, you know, heart of the Rubicon, right near the shop here, it's not growing.
No.
Everything's privately owned. So bought a house there in Georgetown and moved all of my equipment to they've got a huge building over here that they use for, you know, their big equipment stuff. And the race shop's on one end of that building. And I have a section of that race shop. So basically the way I say it to people is that the brothers and I are partners in winning. That's what we're partners in.
Okay.
We're partners in the goal of trying to win. I don't work for them. I have my own payroll, have my own health insurance. My wife does all the books, you know, so we're separate in that way. But we are aligned and teamed up in the sense that we want to win races, you know.
Okay.
I still do work on other people's cars. You know, we just finished a car for Dan Wyrick. I've got another car I'm doing right now for somebody else. We do work for other people here still as well. I'm not just doing just their stuff.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Yep. I was wondering, I'm sure other people understood the dynamics, but I wasn't up on that.
No, most people think that, I'm a GBR employee, which is, you know, I mean, it's understandable that for them to assume that, you know,
right.
But I'm not, I have my own thing. You know, I rarely see them, to be honest with you. You know, I have to kind of force my way to get a meeting with Marcos or JP or Raul because they're busy, dude. They are go, 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 go. And, you know, the only time you know that they've been in the race shop is like if Marcos leaves a Coors Light can on the fab table or something like that, you know, over the weekend, you know?
Yeah, I've been trying to get where I wanted to interview all three of them at once. And, I was told
that's tough.
Yeah, I was told good luck with that. They rarely even have time to sit down, all three of them together. Because they all run different parts of Mountain Enterprise, and they're just, you know, they're the number one. You know, they have more employees. Their largest. What's the best way to put it? They have more employees in El Dorado County with their business than any other business in the county.
Yeah, I think at one time, I think last year before PG&E slowed down, at one point in time, they were also they bought more Ford trucks than for like 2 years in a row than anybody else in America.
Right.
You know,
I remember when Bob got his truck, his current truck, say Paul's current truck. And he went into that same Ford dealer and says, okay, I need this is what I want. And they said, well, you know, our whole allocation, everything that we have, you know, is Gomez's. And he goes, well, just sell me one. They'll understand.
Yeah. That's pretty funny.
So what do you see is coming up in the future?
Cool, man. As far as new cars or technology or in what
in all
forms. What do you mean?
You know, in your life, in the UFO fab shop, does car design, you know, any of that stuff.
So
without giving away right now, industry secrets.
Yeah, no, I get it. I think some of the bigger things that are being missed, and I know that Lauren has alluded to this, and so has Cody at LaserNut. I still think that IFS IRS cars are definitely the future. There's kind of an issue with those things, though. Like, so, for example, at King of the Hammers, the IRS cars, the fully independent cars, are amazing. Okay? And they're amazing when you have, like, a... Remember Reno Nationals where you had or NorCal where you got the long rock gardens that you had to blast through?
Right.
You know, the IFS, IRS, you know, fully independent cars are just incredible through that stuff. They're incredible through nuisance rocks. And they're really good. They're actually, and honestly, people are going to scoff at this. They crawl better than anything else. And you can ask people who have driven Cody Wagoner's car, they'll tell you straight up. It's incredible what they will go through and smoothly. The only downside to the fully independent cars is that when you put them in a short course scenario with the big tires, they tend to drive differently because they have more grip, you know, and obviously it depends on the car layout. There's more things to that, but just in a general speaking sense, they tend to have more grip. So the driver's sensation is a little different. You know, it's just a different sensation. If you take a guy who's used to driving a live axle rear car, right, and you put him in a fully independent car, he's going to come back and tell you that it needs more sway bar and he feels like he's going to flip over. But when you watch video of him, the car might be level and flat, but he's not like the ass end of the car is not hanging out like a Pro 2 truck, right?
Right.
It's more stuck to the ground. And we've seen this because when Mike Bergman had his independent car and also Marcos, is they tear up rear tires more than the live axle cars because they're getting traction. All that horsepower is being used. You know, it's getting put to the ground a little more than you would with a live axle car.
Okay.
I see the fully independent cars being the future, but it's becomes a question of which type, what works the best, you know, and there's a little bit of a venue effect there. So like where you're racing, like if it's just like it's Crandon, for example, I don't think that they would dominate, you know, maybe if you have a purpose built one for Crandon, but, I'm saying generally speaking, you take a car that races KOH and then throw it in Crandon and it's independent, it probably won't do as good as something else, you know?
Right.
But at Hammers, though, which to me, Hammers is the benchmark. Hammers is the benchmark.
True.
You look at Hammers and use Hammers as your only datum point. A fully independent car will dominate that race for sure. And I don't know this for a fact. So someone out there could probably fact check me. But I'm pretty sure Marcos is the only one who is, he's gone through that whole race and has never winched. He has winched before. I'm saying that he has completed the race before and has never pulled a winch line and has made it through every single obstacle without winching or without help. So, and that's in a fully independent car. I don't know who else has done that. I'm sure it's been done. I just don't know who else has done it.
Right.
So they wheel amazing. So I think the fully independent cars are there, and also it's drivetrain technology. The drivetrain stuff, transmissions, like you see Lauren playing with the manual. You see guys like Tommy Dykstra's got a new car being built by Triton that has a Sprag. It's like a carrier bearing slash Sprag assembly. I know that I'm pretty sure Paul Herschel has had a Sprag set up in his car. I think Lauren had one in the fully independent car for a while as well, I think. But those things have proven not to hold up. So there's still progression happening. You know what I'm saying? We're not there yet, but there's progression happening in the drivetrain area. Because that is our weakest link. When you look at an Ultra 4 car, they're kind of like almost high-end tractors in some ways, you know? Like, and I hate to downplay what we've done, but, you know, we have a lot of custom drivetrain parts in our cars, but they're still very simple. You know, our T cases are basic, you know, the drivetrain is beef, everything's locked up, you know, everything's got there's no selectable transfer case. They're pretty rudimentary when you think of them from that standpoint, but the key is they finish races.
Right.
That's the key. That people are missing that too, by the way, is like they finish races. And so in order to win, you got to finish, you know?
Right. With Raul's first car, you guys brought that down and finished it basically on the lake bed.
And it was actually done before that, but Raul's first car was done before that, but I agree with you. It was his first race.
Right.
So in his very first race, he took third. I think the next year he took a second, and I think the year after that was like, I'm trying to remember now. So he did a third, a 10th, a 5th, a blown motor, a 6th, a 3rd, a 1st, and a 1st.
Right.
So from 2016 till now, he's completed every hammers in the top 10, except for one, you know? So, and it wasn't really had anything to do with the car or the drivetrain. It was just he lost a motor.
And the brothers drive. They drive to win. I mean, they are what I call the Robbie Gordon textbook driving. And it's just, well, you know, you're going flat out as fast as that car can go through any section. And you know, if the car survives, you're going to win.
Well, let's rewind that a little bit because it's kind of funny because we can touch on another touchy subject that people have kind of blown out of proportion. You've heard the whole term, the hobby racer thing, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, that was a term that was used, by Vaughn in a positive way, right? He was working with, some of the up and coming, you know, racers. And I think he was given a speech and used the term hobby racer, right? And now that's kind of been like taken out of context and people have been using it kind of a little bit in a derogatory sense. Like they're making fun of Lauren and Vaughn about it, you know, and it's kind of a messed up way to twist the words a little bit. But the reality is the brothers, people are going to laugh when they hear this, but they are hobby racers. Okay.
Right.
And yes, they've won hammers and yes, they've won some races. Right. And yes, they've won some money. So technically you could say that they are professionals. Right. But the reality is their day job, which is consumed for those guys, you know, 12, 14 hour, whatever days they're doing. Right. That's what they're doing every day. When they get back from the races, they aren't even thinking about race cars. Their race cars are completely off their mind. They are 100% focused on work, right?
Right.
So when they get to the races, This goes back to your earlier point, though. When they get to the races, that is their time to cut loose. That's their party time. You know, they all have families. They're all responsible, you know, with their home life and that kind of stuff, right? But the racing is their one outlet where they can just go balls to the walls, let it all hang out, and go for it. And when you look at the three of them, Marcos is the premier example of that. When he's here in the office, like getting to meet with him is like next to impossible, right? And he's just work. Then when it's race day, it's all race, and that's it. And then, you know, and then you've got JP, who's the same way, but he's more of a wheel man. JP's like more of the killer assassin, under pressure, getting, you know, the fastest qualifying time, fastest lap, you know, leading the race. He's that guy. Then you've got Raul, who's the long game guy, right? He's the conservative one, but which also makes him a great KOH driver, by the way.
Right.
He's the conservative one who doesn't go crazy out there. But the reality is they're all doing it as an outlet. It's a part-time outlet. It has nothing to do with their profession, you know?
Right.
I think the only guys who are really doing it professionally would be Vaughn and Lauren, maybe. I don't know. Is Brad Lovell making money from racing? I know he's definitely a professional, right?
Yeah.
But that's, I'm not sure if
that's all consuming. That's part.
Yeah.
His work with Ford is his job, and that's racing.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. So that's a professional. You know, Lauren's a professional. Vaughn's a professional. But pretty much everyone else is out there just having fun, you know?
Right.
Anyway.
I can understand why that was misunderstood, and some people take it the wrong way. It was like when the term rock donkey with Pete was first. I can remember standing around the fire bed or the fire pit at the lake bed, and Pete was racing that week. It wasn't even a full 2 weeks then. It was just a week, and we're all standing around the lake bed and at the fire, and he goes, "You guys just want to be like me." And there was so many guys that all took that wrong, and they were just like up in arms right away. And I said, no, Pete, you said that wrong. And, you know, cause Pete and I were friends. And so I said, you know, I tried to explain to everybody what Pete meant was you all wanted to be able to race trophy trucks, but this is where you're racing. You guys are rock donkeys because you're racing rocks. And, you know, he calls Cameron Steele a donkey, you know,
right.
You know, that was his term. And we just happened to be rock donkeys. And you know, of course, we all took that to the next level, and, you know, the stickers, and it was rock donkey racing and all that when we started, you know, and Schaefer and Lance and all those guys, you know, started racing down there in Baja. But it was, you know, it was the term was misunderstood, or the what Pete was trying to put across is you want to be like me. No, you want to be like a trophy truck driver. Everybody wants to race at that highest level.
Yep.
You know, and Pete was misunderstood that way. Most everybody realized it later on. You know, that's a guy that's going to be missed. I don't know if you ever got a chance to meet him, but he was an interesting individual.
Yep, very outspoken. And he was pretty close to being on point a lot of the time. You know, he wasn't always on point, but he had a pretty good track record.
Right. And one thing, at least in the desert world, is that he may have been the most underfunded trophy truck team out there.
Right.
When I pitted for him and helped him out, there was, you know, we had like two or three pickup trucks with, you know, I remember the first time I showed up, they had a whole bunch of tools and toolboxes laid out on the back of a trailer, and we were trying to organize the toolboxes so that we'd have enough tools for each one of the chase trucks to go down the road and hopefully make a repair if needed. I mean, there was no real organization because everybody just showed up, you know, at the last minute. And it was, but you know, the guy could drive. you know, for one eye, the guy just was an incredible driver. You know, and he loved to piss off Robbie Gordon.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
So, what about personally?
You know, I've been trying to get myself better on the business side of things. You know, I'm not really a big business person in general. I don't think about money a whole lot, you know, and I'm not like consumed by it, but I do know that, getting things on a more professional plane in that sense is important. And so we've been doing work there, you know, the wife has really gone through and like fixed a lot of stuff with our books and, made my billing out a little better. And I would like to get some production stuff going in the future, but the problem is it doesn't interest me very much. So if it's not an interest, it's hard for me to like put the energy in there.
Right.
But I do know that there's a lot of stuff that people have asked for from us that, I haven't produced, you know, and if I did, it'd probably help a lot of people out and it makes some extra income, that kind of stuff. But that's an area that I'd like to improve, you know, for myself, you know, or for the company and for the guys, just to get a little more like a residual income coming in besides just the cars. But other than that, man, we were supposed to build a trophy truck. But the brothers have slowed down a little bit. So we're kind of backburner that, which kind of is a bummer. Cause we had a really cool platform, set up and, we did a lot of work on that thing on the CAD side of things. And I was really looking forward to launching a UFO designed TT truck, four-wheel drive TT truck of our own design. Right.
Right.
And, cause I felt like we had something different to bring to the table and, you know, that still can happen in the future. It's just right now we're not doing that, but, in the future I would love to do that. That's been my ultimate goal. My ultimate goal has always been to build a TT, like from the early days. Like I always thought that somehow I'm building a trophy truck, you know?
Right.
And so, you know, that's one of them. And you know, I want to do some UTV stuff. But other than that, I want to just keep progressing the cars and kind of incrementally pushing things forward. And I just want to win more races, dude, honestly, like that feeling of watching these guys, these drivers win, you know, if I'm not at the racer, I'm at home. It's nerve wracking. And I love that feeling watching someone like Raul or JP or Paul Wolf or whoever it is, right, do well and, you know, get pole position for qualifying or whatever it is. Those are all huge wins. And I'm super thankful to see that stuff happen. And it's addicting. You want to do it every time, you know? So definitely want to get another KOH win. I really want to be the first to win KOH in a fully independent car. You know, first, you know, builder anyway, right?
Right.
You know, we've been close. We've been really close. And I do feel like we have the toughest and one of the fastest, you know, fully independent platforms. Just getting the cars to fall where they may, you know. I mean, that one year, Marcos came from last to first. He passed every car in the entire field, you know, only to have a Heim joint break at the end of the very last few miles. And he'll tell you it was his fault. He said he nosed in really heavy into a ditch and he knew he heard it. And then, the Heim joint finally gave it up just a couple miles from the finish. And when he hit another G out, and that's that, right?
Right.
But I do feel that he has the ability to win that race if luck goes his way. By the way, that race when he passed every car, started from last or whatever, I think he got 10 flats. He came into the pits one time with 3 flats at once. He was pushing. He is relentless with that car.
Right.
So pretty impressive. But I just want to win, man. That's all it really is to it. I mean, I know it sounds like a really simplistic and boring thing or boring goal, but I just want to see the cars be on the podium all, you know, from any of the drivers, by the way. Like, I like to see Paul Wolf do well. I'd see Raul do well, and all the brothers, my brother, you know, I really want to see my brother do well. Honestly, I think, you know, he's really coming into his own as a driver right now. He's getting way more comfortable in the car, and he's coming into his own, like, confidence wise. You know what I mean?
Right.
He's starting to believe in himself as far as the driver is concerned. So I know I'm really hoping that he can put something together. I'd love to see him get a top five finish at Hammers. That'd be amazing. You know, be a super proud moment, you know, watching him do that. So that's all I really have, man. I don't really have a whole bunch of other stuff other than to ride my mountain bike as much as possible.
There you go.
I'm getting old, you know.
Keep in shape.
Yeah.
I'm fighting that right now. So it's,
Oh yeah, me too. My back's jacked up. And if I don't ride, it tightens up instantly, which a couple days, and I'm limping around like an old man. And, you know, as soon as I get on the bike and ride a little bit, I feel great. You know, I just got to keep moving. That's all there is to it.
Yep. Movement is very, very important.
There is one other thing I thought would be kind of interesting to touch on. I don't know if we have time for this.
Absolutely. We always have time. Yep.
There's a couple things that I think are important, and I'm not sure I'll probably get heat for this, but, and I think it's an important thing to touch on because it affects the sport, you know, and that is the whole, and Lauren will tell you, Lauren will laugh about this. Lauren and I have had lots of conversations. We've had conversations both publicly and privately about this. But it's like kind of like a two-part deal. You mentioned earlier about Pete and the Rock Donkeys and that kind of stuff.
Right.
And, you know, the uniqueness of our sport is incredible, right?
True.
And my stance on our venues and where we're racing and the cars, this kind of goes along with the cars thing that you asked me earlier, is I don't know if my position is unique because I've talked to other top drivers. Like I'll just name drop right now. I've talked to Shannon about this, for example, and Shannon's in agreement as long as pretty much everyone else I've talked to on this matter. And that is, our sport is unique. We're racing our cars through stuff that the TTs avoid, right? Or absolutely, the class ones avoid. And we're subjecting the cars to loads and impacts that you really can't design. You can't account for in a computer very well. You know, so for example, if you're designing a trophy truck, right? You know that your intended course, your intended terrain is this, right? And take out crashes out of that equation because you can't really account for a crash. A crash is are loads to the car that you'll never, you know, be able to plan for, right?
Right.
But in our sport, we know that we're going through a rock pile, and we know that we're going to be going somewhat fast. We know we're going to hit a load from this direction, that direction, etc. Makes the sport totally unique. So building cars that will go through that stuff requires a lot from that car, right? It requires a unique approach to design. And when you look at the hard engineering of it, like the numbers of what loads go where, what impacts do what's going to do what's going to break the steering rack off the car. Like if you look at history right now, the past 5 years, the amount of steering racks that have been blown off a car or have been broken is astronomical, right? So that just shows you that the lows that these cars are seeing, the impacts are seeing are incredibly great, you know? And so because the car is unique and because Hammers, we'll say Hammers again, Hammers is the baseline course, right?
Absolutely.
The idea of taking those cars and then going racing somewhere else is awesome. Like I like the fact that we race at NorCal and then we race at the old, Reno venue, right? But even those courses, the NorCal Rock Race is the best example of this. They have a natural rock section as well as like a man-made rock section. And in the natural rocks, man, those guys, you have to slow down. Otherwise, you're going to destroy your car instantly. Right. You have to slow down and you have to show some driving tact, some control to get through it and not kill your car, right? And then continue on your race and actually win, right?
Yes.
So when you look at the courses that we've had, you know, like when you look at Crandon, for example, Crandon had the man-made rock sections, right? Which they were nothing more than a whoop section in Supercross. You know, the difference is that they're made of sharp boulders versus actual rounded dirt whoops. But the fastest cars, you just hold it open and just blast across them. You know, that's literally what you're doing. That's not a whole lot of thought. So it's a two-part thing that I'm kind of bringing up, and that is I actually, and Lauren already knows this, I really believe that there should be, it's really hard, it's a gray area, but not there should be only one car, but I think the cars need to highlight the terrain that we're driving through, and I believe the courses need to highlight the capabilities of the car.
Absolutely.
So like these courses that are short courses with like a little sprinkling of rocks, that doesn't do it. That's not enough. You need to have some obstacles in there that slow these cars down. There, it takes you got to punch over the top of something. You know, you got to come to a stop, get over an obstacle. Maybe there's another one right after it. You know, you got two cars and alternating lines, three cars, whatever it is, alternating lines, getting through this stuff. Then once they get through that section, they're back up to speed again, right? Amazing. That's what fans want to see. And so the courses need to match the cars, and the cars need to match the course. And so, I don't know. I'll call out Lauren right now, is that to me, the true mark of a good car is that it literally can do everything and can compete in every venue and be competitive. Right.
Right.
Not just being also ran, you know, and that's where I'm the most proud of our cars, that they've shown they can do short course and they aren't as fat. Like I'll say it right now, like the new car that Keith built for Jason Shear.
Right.
That's a fast desert car, dude. That's a fast, fast, fast desert car. I do think in a hammer situation, we probably have an advantage over him in some of the bigger rocks. But he has an advantage in the desert, right? And so, you know, you have to have that balance. And so that's why I always go back to not having five cars for five events, you know, five different cars for five different venues. You know, you go to Crandon, I mean,
you should be racing the same car at every single venue.
Yeah, there's I know there's got to be an out or a rule for a broken car or something like same way you have with drivers.
Right.
That kind of thing. I really think that needs to be in place, because you can't alienate someone if they have a broken car, they cartwheel, they destroy their car. That's totally understandable. You know, there's got to be
one change in the season.
Or if you have a new car being built and you're ready to unleash it, I get all that stuff.
Right.
But you know, having four cars in the trailer and then choosing the car that you want to race depending on the track that you're at, I think is against the spirit of our racing, you know, situation. Plus it also brings down everybody else. You know, like if you know, I'll tell you right now, if I was given the green light right now to build a short course only car, let's say Paul Wolf called me up tomorrow and said, "Hey Joe, here's $500,000, build me the baddest short course car you can build," right? It would not look anything like the car he's driving now. It would be a totally different platform. But that car would not go through hammers.
Right.
You know? And so, but that takes away from the sport. It takes away from other people competing. You know? I mean, the majority of our sport is comprised of hobby racers. And that's not meant as a derogatory. It's meant as these are people that are spending their hard-earned workday cash on a car, right? They're trying to be competitive. They're trying to go out there and win hammers and be competitive at the other venues. Well, why would they want to show up if I'm showing up with the Gomez brothers with 10 different cars and we're picking and choosing the best car for that venue and knowing that the guy who showed up in his Jimmy Stresa car is just going to get smoked the moment he leaves the line?
Right.
You know? That's just not a good way to get people to the start line. But also the promoters need to build courses that complement the cars as well.
Agreed. You know? Agreed.
You know, so anyway, that's just something I think is important. I also think it's important for the sport in general.
Well, I think it equates the same thing as what's happening in Trophy Truck right now. I mean, look at the numbers of the Trophy Trucks at Baja this last week compared to years past. Everybody, so many people are dropping into the spec cars or the trophy, you know, the smaller trophy trucks design, because they're more affordable and it becomes more of a driver instead of, you know, a bank account.
Yeah. So I actually don't know the answer to this question, but in Spec TT, you cannot run four-wheel drive, correct? No four-wheel drive in Spec TT.
I believe that's the case. I don't know. I don't know that for sure.
I don't either. So it'd be a neat thing to know, but I can see that though, because like, I mean, Mason has done such an incredible job of come out of the gate with an amazing, you know, TT platform, right? In four-wheel drive that works and is finishing races and is obviously incredibly fast, right?
Right.
So anyone else who's showing up is showing up hoping that they break. That the Mason in front of them is going to break.
True.
Yep. Versus showing up knowing that they can compete against the guy who just left the line before or after them and they're actually racing each other, you know? So it's the same thing with us. You know, we want to have, I think there should be venues that complement the cars and cars need to complement the venue. And, you know,
even if it means
excited about showing up,
even if it means, you know, doing it man-made and pouring concrete to simulate, you know, the drops and the climbs that you have to do at KOH.
Well, if you remember, I know you remember this cause I know you were there, but, remember the Oroville rock crawling stuff?
Oh yeah. I put on a lot of events there.
Yeah. So exactly. So remember the giant culvert that everyone would have to go up, bump up and over.
Yep.
Okay. And only a handful of guys did it. If I remember correctly, you know, but you take, and I know like Goodby can't do this at NorCal Rock Race because he's constrained by the state. The state won't let him do certain things on that course. Right. So he can't go and put in six of those big giant culverts and stagger them and have the cars go through them. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
Or go over them. The state won't let him do that. But there are other venues where they have some flexibility to do something like that, you know, where you've got a, like I said, you're coming in at 50 miles an hour, you come around a corner, you hit the brakes and boom, you stop, low range, pop over this obstacle, go to the other side, hit one more after that, pop over, change ratio and take the hell off. That to me is what we need, is something of that nature.
Yeah, we built a rock crawling facility in Tucson at that what was originally Pima Motorsports Park and then became MC Motorsports Park. And it was the first race that Vaughn came down and raced with Randy. Randy was navigating for him. And at least it was the first time he raced Dirt Riot. And that place there was set up like that. I mean, they went out in a desert section and they did 5 or 6 miles of desert and a lot of it was narrow. You know, if you made a mistake, you had Choya, you know, cactus balls, you know, everywhere. there was a short course section, you know, which was like more of a motor, like a GP motocross area, you know, nothing super radical. And then it went down into the rock, into the bowl, which was all concrete, man-made stuff that we had
features,
produced.
Yeah.
And it was badass. I mean, in fact, it was almost too hard. We had to take everybody through the easier lines because the stuff that was built there was built for competitive rock crawling. And, it was a blast watching the guys come in there and, you know, that's where all the spectators hung out. It was right there. You know, some would go out to the GP course to watch them jump, but most of the time everybody hung out at the, you know, along the fence line to the pit so that they could watch the cars go through the rocks.
Right.
You know, or the concrete. And it was cool. And so if anybody is out there is listening and agrees with this and has a piece of property and wants to race course or has a race organization that needs some concrete work designed and wants to do it right, I know some people available to do that.
That'd be amazing. I do think, and the reason I think this is a big topic is because everyone keeps talking about like building a sport and getting more sponsors and that kind of stuff. I think that the one thing that makes the sport unique needs to be magnified and highlighted and propped up for everyone to see, you know?
Agree.
Because it's different. There is no other motorsport on the planet that I know of that has cars going through the same type of stuff or the same variety of terrain like the Ultra 4 cars are doing.
Well,
and to me, that says something.
It's obvious. You don't see crowds out at KOH at the lake beds where guys are hitting 130 miles an hour. Where do you see the crowds? This was even back in the old days where you could go anywhere, you know, and stand right on the side of the race course.
Cade Rod made this point on one of his podcasts a couple podcasts ago, and he's spot on, is that you have to bring back that element of Wild West. Now, I know it's got to be controlled and safe, but you have to bring that back. It's something that makes the sport intense and unique. And his, I don't know if you heard his idea, but I think it's pretty good, which is if you pull a winch, you're getting some kind of time penalty, you know? And the idea would be to encourage you to drive the course, not just take the safe way out every time. Right. And I don't see anything wrong with something like that. Some variation of that would be amazing. And I don't know. To me, we need to highlight what these cars can do, and we got to make the courses highlight what they can do.
Right. I agree.
Which I think Reno did really well. If you think about Reno, Reno did a good job of that, because even though they're going downhill in those bigger rocks, it was still fairly treacherous. You couldn't just go straight down.
No, that was
obvious.
There
were guys that did, there was guys that did that paid the price. But I'm just saying you couldn't just go straight down with complete and total reckless abandon. And then, you know, then you had some short course, you had some hill climbs, stuff thrown in there. There's a good variety, you know, which,
right.
I think this is true, but I'm pretty sure Ultra 4 is the only one that sold that venue out, even over the Pro 2s and Pro 4 trucks.
Right.
I'm pretty sure the Ultra 4 race is the only one that ever sold the stands out. And that was incredible. You know, it was a super fun place to watch the races. And the cars were being put to the test in every kind of, you know, they had a lot of things, a variety of terrain to hit, which is amazing.
And that was the Tooele had that in a way, you know, they
except
had the short course part and then, you know, the rock through the concrete areas, you know, again, it was all designed for competitive rock crawling, which is, you know, slow and technical, which the guys really needed to slow down or, you know, they'd eat shit. You'd say, you know, this is the best way to put it, but, you know, that would be nice to have that place be able to come back and actually go out there and have it built by somebody that is building it for that specific type of racing.
Sure.
You know.
And I you always wonder, like you, if you took a poll of all the drivers, how they like that venue. I've heard mixed reviews, like, because I've raced there, and I liked it, except for the mud part. That was weird mud. If it rained there,
it was
an absolute nightmare. But it was kind of narrow in some spots, you know, like when you went through those rocks, there wasn't a whole lot of ways to run the cars through those narrows or through the man-made rock section.
Right.
But it was still cool though. It still had the right mixture of stuff.
Right.
That's all. Had the right mixture.
Yeah. And that, again, it was, you know, especially in the rocks where you're talking about narrow, those areas were designed for that competitive rock crawling. So instead of making it, you know, for racing where you get three cars or four cars through it at one time, it was designed for one car at a time navigating cones. You know, it was never designed with the idea of hauling ass through it.
Correct.
So,
yep.
Yeah. Same thing with the Tucson. You know, we had to be real specific where we let the cars go through. Although it would have been great just to open it wide open and just said, okay, you guys try to figure it out. But it would have just been mayhem in there. And,
right.
You know, and one thing I hate in racing is bottlenecks. You know, whenever I designed a course, whether, you know, with our Dirt Riot racing, it was always like, okay, where are we going to have the biggest problem in a bottleneck and how are we going to deal with it? And, you know, that was first and foremost in my course design.
Right.
You know, I didn't want the bottlenecks.
I agree. It's got to be wide enough. You got to have courses that complement the cars 100%, you know, and that's how you're going to build interest, you know, is getting people excited about watching it and getting the drivers excited about driving it. Cause there is a lot of courses. Sorry, promoters, if anyone's hearing this, but there are courses out there that are just straight boring.
Right.
And not like the drivers aren't going, oh my God, that was amazing. You know, when the driver says that was an incredible course to drive, that's a good thing.
Right.
You know, when they like the course and it gives them some satisfaction, you know, that's, you want that. I mean, Reno had that, and I think NorCal has that. And I know there's other races that have that as well, but I'm just saying that that's an important factor to get car count up.
Agreed. Well, cool. Joe, I want to say thank you so much for spending the time on this Sunday morning and talking with me and letting everybody that listens to this, which seems to be quite a few, are going to enjoy this, I believe, and learn more about you. And that's the whole goal.
Well, again, I appreciate it. Honored to be on here. Feel blessed to talk with you and have this adventure, you know, so I appreciate it.
All right. You take care, and we'll talk some more. And I got to swing by the shop. I mean, hell, I'm only like 10 minutes away.
I know. I agree.
You gotta come by. I've been saying this for a year and a half now.
Well, you got to come by because we got something new we're working on right now. It's in there. It's kind of, it'll be a first for UFO. So
excellent. I will swing by then. Excellent.
All right. Okay. Sounds good.
Okay. Talk to you later. Bye.
All right. Bye.
Well, that's another episode of Conversations with Big Rich. I'd like to thank you all for listening. If you could do us a favor and leave us a review on any podcast service that you happen to be listening on, or send us an email or a text message or a Facebook message, and let me know any ideas that you have, or if there's anybody that you have that you think would be a great guest, please forward the contact information to me so that we can try to get them on. And always remember, live life to the fullest. Enjoying life is a must. Follow your dreams and live life with all the gusto you can. Thank you.